Hello and welcome in.
First science. Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio.
Hello and welcome to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. There's a whole lot of history in your body. That scar from when you were four, the piercing mark from that teenage wild phase. But it turns out that things go a lot deeper than that. Our bones and our teeth can tell us so much about our own life, as long as you know how to look for it. My guest today is Kat Jarman, a bioarchaeologist from Bristol, who investigates the diet and mobility of our ancestors using the bones they have left behind. Thank you for joining us, Kat.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's great to have you. And I think I'm going to start with a bit of a fun question, which is, because you spend so much time thinking about the past, if you were able to be transported back in time for 24 hours, where would you go?
Right. So this might be a little bit of a weird one. I think I would like to go back to somewhere called Oseberg in Norway in around about the year 820. I'd actually want to go to a funeral.
Okay.
Which might sound a little bit
choice.
Morbid. There's a good reason for it. This would be the funeral of two women buried on one of the most famous Viking ships ever.
Oh, really?
The Oseberg ship, which I used to go to and visit when I was a child. And we know quite a lot about these skeletons and bodies and all the beautiful objects, but we know really nothing about their real lives. And I'd like to go there and find out about them, find out who they were, why they were buried like that, and experience the whole sort of very dramatic and exciting event, I think.
So what do they have? What do they have on them? What do we know about what they were buried?
They were very, very high status. They had a whole complete, a very large ship. They had lots of really ornate equipment with them. They had animals. They had a ceremonial sledge. So there was clearly a whole big sort of performance around the funeral. And we don't know why. We don't know who they were. So
wow.
I'd love to go back and find out.
Yeah, so I've asked this question and I just can't, I don't know where I'd go. There's just too many.
Yes.
So people should let us know. They get to at Science Mixtape. Let them know where, if you were to go back in time, where would you end up with just for 24 hours? Right, so we're going to have your first song. We've got Mika Hinson with Beneath the Rose. Any particular reason for this one?
Mainly because I really like it, but the lyrics remind me of the fact that there's all these stories and all these lives that we don't know anything about. And people who had all sorts of experiences. And I don't think they really wrote about archaeology, but that's what it reminds me of.
Well, here we go, Beneath the Rose.
It is said that you cannot be found under rocks of broken skull. I will lay down, I will lay down. I can be found beneath the rose, beneath the rose, alone. Safe to say that I'll never be found. Broken bones holding loose, you will be.
That was Mika P. Hinson with Beneath the Rose. So, Kat, I have to be honest, I haven't heard of a bioarchaeologist before. It's a new one on me. So could you describe kind of what you do in maybe a few words?
Yeah, I think to put it very simply, I use forensic methods on human remains to try to reconstruct past lives and sort of unlock some of the chemical signatures that can tell us about those lives and what people did in the past.
Right. Okay. And so, what kind of remains are you working on? How are you pulling out this information?
So I work on human remains. So they can be of any age. Most of my research has been on Viking Age material, and also working on Rapa Nui or Easter Island, like we'll talk about a bit later on.
Yeah.
And I use especially a method called isotope analysis, which is looking at sort of chemical signatures in bone, especially in all sorts of tissues, really, but especially in bone, that retain certain information about past environments, past movement, past diet.
Okay, what actually is the information that you're looking for? So the bone can hold this information, but what is it? Is it the structure or is it the chemical makeup?
Yeah, so it's sort of certain characteristics or of the elements that we have in our body. So we have all sorts of different elements in our skin and our bone and our teeth. And some of those reflect certain things. Some of them reflect our diet. Some of them reflect the geographic environment that we grew up in and the places where we ate our food. So we try to sort of get to those signals, essentially. Try to get that and see what that can tell us about that person's life.
Right, so if I eat, you know, a piece of fish, then that piece of fish has a chemical in it, but that chemical kind of goes into my body. But surely that chemical is just the same chemical in all fish. So how can you tell the difference between fish from one place and fish from another?
Yeah, so that's exactly where it gets really interesting, because we really are what we eat. So all our tissues, all our skin, bone, that's all created from the food that we eat. So while we're talking, we're sort of growing hair and fingernails and cells and everything. And
somewhat slowly, but...
A bit slowly, yeah, exactly.
But it's getting there.
It's getting there. But that material has to come from the food that we eat. And the food isn't actually all the same. So if you can imagine grains, so wheat, if you had a sandwich for lunch, the wheat was growing perhaps locally in southern England. Mm-hmm. And that wheat got its nutrients from the soil. And those soil characteristics are actually different in different parts of the world.
Ah, right.
So it's kind of all those things that those plants take up are passed on through the food chain into the food and into you as the consumer.
So there's these different chemical elements of the thing, but you also do stuff with kind of the actual isotopes, like the atoms of that make up the chemical bonds. So how are they different from place to place?
So it depends a bit which element we're looking at. So one really good example of this is when we look at strontium isotope analysis. Mm-hmm. So that's what we use for looking at past mobility, so trying to find out if somebody has migrated in the past.
So strontium's like a metal? Is it a heavy metal?
It's a mineral, a metal. And it's pretty much present in everything, really. But what we're interested in is the strontium isotopes that are in geology. So mm-hmm. if we look at strontium in say your sandwich, in your bread that you're eating,
right,
then that will have come from essentially the soil that wheat was grown in.
Right.
And that soil has come from the underlying bedrock. And that bedrock has obviously a certain type of geology, which has a certain variation or sort of a ratio or two different types of strontium isotopes.
Ah, right. So you're looking at the ratios in the different, you know, populations of the two different isotopes, and that can help you pin down like one particular area. Now, yep. how accurate can you get? Could you get to one field, or are you talking about, you know, maybe one part of a country? How accurate is this method?
It's usually larger regions that we talk about, because we're looking at the differences in geology. So, for example, we look at places that have a certain type of isotope ratio, has maybe very old rocks, so granites, for example. So if I look at Vikings, I want to look at Norway, which has got very, very old geology, whereas somewhere like southwest Britain has got very young, chalky geology. You're sort of looking at those geological areas.
And it's over the geological time that you can actually get these differences between the two isotopes.
Exactly. So, but then you can narrow it down, because you can use several different elements together. So you can look at strontium, and then you can look at oxygen, for example, which relates to, from water. So you can look at things that relate to climate, altitude, and so on. And so you can piece together all these different isotopes and actually start to narrowing it down.
This is kind of the basis of like when people date things, radiocarbon dating, like they're looking at the same thing. They're looking at the ratio of isotopes. Is that very related to what you do, or is yours a kind of a broader field that incorporates that?
So similar principles. So with radiocarbon dating, you look very specifically at the radioactive isotope of carbon, so carbon-14. And so again, you are looking at, in that case, you're actually looking at how much that has decayed over time. So it's a slightly different principle.
Oh, right.
But it's breaking down one particular element into those little sort of constituent parts. So you're really sort of going very, very small and then looking at that evidence.
Brilliant. Well, you've pulled us on very nicely to our next track, which is Radioactive by Imagine Dragons. Come on, did you plan that?
I did, yes. Quite. Yeah. I
okay.
couldn't resist.
So here it is. This is Imagine Dragons with Radioactive.
I'm waking up to ash and dust. I wipe my brow and I sweat my rust. I'm breathing.
the chemicals.
That was Imagine Dragons with Radioactive, very applicable. We're just hearing a bit about these radioactive isotopes and how actually you use isotope population ratios to determine where people are from. And so we've heard a bit about these techniques, and I know that specifically you've been using this technique with a burial at Repton. So what's the story there?
Yeah, so this is a really...
Oh, hang on. Wait a second. What's the story at Repton? Let's try that one more time. You need to put your mic up. That would help.
Ah, yes. Okay. Yeah, so obviously I think this is really exciting. I've spent the last 5 years or so working on a Viking site in Repton in Derbyshire. It was discovered in the 1970s and 80s, and it was known from historical records to be a site of a winter camp of the Viking Great Army that sort of marauded around the country. And archaeologists found several graves that were definite Viking graves, somebody buried with a Thor's hammer around his neck and a Viking sword, for example. And there was also a mound that had a very large mass grave in it containing the bodies of nearly 300 people, all kind of mixed up, along with Viking weapons and various other artefacts.
All right. So and this was like a mass grave, so there were lots of different people in there?
Yeah, so lots of people buried together. It was thought they were probably the remains of this the Viking Great Army, people maybe who died in battle and were buried together.
Ah, right, okay,
and
I see.
That's what the sort of archaeological interpretation seemed to be.
And so this was, when was this? This was 800 and something, is that?
Yeah, so 873 AD.
Okay, right. Okay.
Quite precisely.
Wow, 873 AD. don't mess around with these dates here.
No. So we know that because we've got historical records saying that's when the Viking Great Army came to Repton.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So like written records?
Yeah, the Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, which is written down in the 9th century, actually tells us about this.
Oh, that's really cool.
And then we have this grave, and there were coins in there dating to exactly 872 to 875 AD. So backing it up. Perfectly.
Brilliant. And so, what were you able to learn about this grave? You think that people thought it was all Vikings, or
yeah. So that was the interpretation. Everything seemed like these were the Vikings, but then some radiocarbon dates came back in the late 90s, and they seemed to suggest that some of these humans, they dated about 20 different people. Some of them actually dated to about 700 AD, so or even a bit earlier, so a couple of hundred years before the Vikings even arrived in England.
Right, okay.
That was really confusing because the archaeologist was saying, you know, screaming, this is the Vikings.
Yeah, we've got written records and coins, and then the science is saying something different.
Yeah, exactly. So
what was the theory there? Did people think that it was maybe they'd been reburied or...?
Yeah, so, I mean, they were clearly bodies that had been moved anyway. So one theory was that they were just sort of slightly random Anglo-Saxon burials that had been taken out and placed in alongside all these Viking dead, but... none of that really seemed to make sense. So part of what I wanted to do was to look at if we had any new scientific methods that could really help solve the mystery, I guess.
Right. And what was that?
So I was looking at the radiocarbon dates. We sent up some new dates to see if there was a problem with the equipment in the 1990s.
Yeah.
But the new ones came out the same. Some of the bones were clearly coming up as much earlier. But we now know that you actually have to look at where that carbon that you're dating comes from. So the way we radiocarbon date things, we look at the carbon-14 and how much that has decayed since the organism died.
Yeah.
And we know that that carbon gets into their system from their food, like we were talking about earlier. But most of the assumption is that comes straight from the atmosphere, so into the food, into the plants, from the atmosphere.
Right.
But we now know that if you eat some of your food from other sources like oceans or rivers, you're actually also consuming carbon that is of a much older age. So carbon in the ocean has been circulating for a very long time.
Okay, so it's like because it's come out, it's not in rocks anymore, but it's gone through the food chain quite a few times.
Yeah, so it's been there. So the carbon-14 comes from the atmosphere into the ocean, circulates for about 400 years or so, gets into the fish, and then gets eaten by the humans.
Right, okay.
So if you had fish in your sandwich, a lunch, a tuna sandwich or something like that, you would have had some very sort of modern carbon, but you'd also be eating some very old carbon. And that's going to completely mess up the right radiocarbon dates if I wanted to date your hair or your bones, basically.
Okay, so you accounted for this effect, and then what did you find?
Yeah, so I looked at another isotope, so stable carbon, carbon-13, which can also tell us something about how much fish somebody has eaten, because again, there's a difference between the ratios in fish and terrestrial food sources.
Right.
So I could use that to estimate how much fish these possible Vikings had been eating, and then account for that offset. So if somebody who only ate fish would be 400 years older than, or seem like they were 400 years older than they really were, then somebody who ate only terrestrial foods would be sort of perfect. So you put them on a sort of sliding scale, and then you account for it. And when I did that, it turned out that all of those individuals who had early radiocarbon dates had all been eating fish, basically.
Right, okay.
So that completely changed the radiocarbon dates and made all of them completely consistent with a 9th century date, which is exactly what the archaeologist said all along.
All right, so we were right all along.
Yeah, exactly.
And was there anything else that you could learn from like these ratios and stuff? Like, do you know where they came from? Were you able to kind of specify that a little bit better? Or?
Yeah, so that's kind of work in progress. Now, so obviously a radiocarbon date in the 9th century doesn't make somebody a Viking.
Yeah.
They could easily be Anglo-Saxons who just happened to die on the same day as well. So that's part of my ongoing work now, is to look at those strontium isotopes and all those geographical markers and things to see if I can find out.
So stay tuned, and we might find out a little bit about actually where they came from.
Yeah, hopefully.
I'm sure that there's some of my ancestors in there. I'm a very, very Viking looking guy.
Yeah, definitely have that Viking look about you.
Yeah, my dad has got this I can't remember what it's the thing where your fingers curl up.
Yeah.
Which is like a specifically Viking trait. So, and I am the spitting image of my father, so I'm probably gonna get that. So definitely Viking here.
Excellent.
Right, we're gonna move on to your next song. Which is a from a soundtrack, actually, from Detectorists. This is Johnny Flynn. Is there any reason you chose this one?
Yeah, so this show, I quite enjoyed the show. It's about metal detectorists. We're also very interested in the past, obviously. I work quite a lot with metal detectorists in my job as an archaeologist when I don't do the lab work. And I think this is a nice tune to sort of represent some of what they do.
Yeah, I have to say, I really enjoyed this this show, actually. It's a really lovely, really lovely pace, you know, kind of show. So here it is. This is the theme from Detectorists by Johnny Flynn.
Will you search through the lonely earth for me? Climb through the briar and bramble. I'll be your treasure. I felt the touch of the kings and the breath of the wind. I knew the call of all the songbirds. They sang all the wrong words. I'm waiting for you. I'm waiting for you.
That was Johnny Flynn with the theme from The Detectorists, which was a great show about, you know, a bit about history, about something we were talking. They really wanted to find this Viking hoard. That was their desire. And so, you know, that you were investigating exactly what they wanted to investigate. So there's something else that you've been looking into, which is actually the remains from Rapa Nui.
Yeah.
Or Easter Island, or Isla de Pascua, whatever, however you want to do it. There's so many names. And what have you been looking into there?
Yeah, so this was quite an exciting opportunity that I had a few years ago to collaborate with research from the University of Hawaii. And we wanted to look at Rapa Nui, especially to look at marine food consumption, because slightly bizarrely, despite this being a tiny island in the middle of nowhere with thousands of miles to the nearest landmass, there's been a lot of suggestions that they weren't actually eating a lot of fish, which doesn't seem very logical.
No, it doesn't. No. I mean, you're surrounded by water. I'd eat some fish.
Yeah, exactly. And nobody really knew that much about it. And when I started this, we didn't really have any sort of kind of real evidence. So we wanted to look at, see if we could use isotope analysis to analyse this.
Right.
It was also very much tied up to something called the ecocide debate, where the Rapa Nui population has very much been blamed for destroying their own environment by cutting down all the trees, and part of that also turning their backs on the sea, not using those resources but overusing the land-based resources.
Yeah, I mean, this has always been kind of said as like a parable of the world, you know, that there was, I'm going to butcher the history now, but this is what I've heard. There are two tribes, like long ears and the short ears. They went to war, they cut all the trees down, they like destroyed all their natural resources, and then were left on this barren island and ended up dying.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the standard, you know, pop interpretation of what happened to them.
Yeah, so that's a typical story. And obviously how they use their resources is a big part of that. So we thought, let's get some isotopes in and have a look. Managed to get hold of some material that we can analyse. So we actually went into much more detail, really quite exciting sort of high resolution data. We were looking at individual amino acids, which is going into your bone and into the collagen that's in your bones, and then breaking that down as completely into the sort of separate amino acids. And they, again, tell us something about the different types of foods that people had been eating.
Right.
We managed to find that actually it seemed like they were eating quite a lot of fish.
Okay.
At least sort of 50% of the diet came from the oceans, which makes perfect sense. But we also found some other quite unexpected information that comparing some of these amino acids in the human bone to the food sources that they had around them. So they had chickens and rats and fish were sort of the animals that they could eat. And none of them really reflected the values that we found in the humans.
Right.
So it seemed like they were getting food that had a very different isotopic signal. So actually, we were looking at nitrogen isotopes. Mm-hmm. And we came to the conclusion that they must have actually planted foods in very specific environments, meaning that they had been using fertilizers to sort of alter those soils.
Right. So you were getting the signal from other foods, like through the plants in some way.
Yeah, so it's evidence of the environmental conditions that the plants were growing in were passed on through the food chain and into the people that were eating them. So we could see that they weren't just eating natural foods, they were actually very deliberately managing their resources. They were managing their soils, using fertilizers. We also analyzed soils in that we knew had been agricultural soils, and they had different isotopic ratios from normal soils, which told us that actually they had quite sophisticated methods of producing food and sort of making sure they had a really good food supply.
So you're really challenging these kind of conceptions that they really didn't know what they were doing and they destroyed their resources. You're saying that they were actually quite good at managing the land and looking after what they were farming and eating.
Because it's actually quite a difficult environment to survive in. It's a sort of difficult island environment, but really they had very sophisticated techniques. So lots of other evidence is now backing that up. So we think actually there isn't really much of this evidence that they were destroying their environments. And actually, it was really Westerners when they came and brought communicable diseases and things like that. Completely devastated the population.
So I've actually been to Easter Island, and it's absolutely fascinating. One thing I do vividly remember is that there's not that much of a native population there, but there are still people who are there.
Yeah.
And I remember when we landed, there's an incredibly long runway when you land. And apparently it's because the Americans built a very long runway so that it could be a ditch point for the space shuttle.
Oh, really?
So it's got a really long runway so you can land a space shuttle on it. And so you're flying over the runway for minutes being like, when is this plane going to land? But when we got there and we got into the airport, one of the guys who was a baggage handler looked like a Moai. He looked like the statue.
Yeah.
He had this long, flat forehead and long, straight nose. And it was just like, okay.
Now I see
where they got all the shapes of the faces and everything, because he really looks like the statue.
Yeah,
it was
fantastic.
Kind of amazing. You were saying that you were getting these kind of isotopes from different parts of the body. How do different parts of the body change what you can learn?
Yeah, so that's another really interesting question, actually, because so our tissues are sort of constantly remodeling. Like I was saying, you know, we're currently really, really busy growing hair and nails. Our bones are turning over as well, which is great if you break a leg. It means that it can actually heal and you can fix yourself. But it happens at a different rate. So, for example, a femur or thigh bone will take about 15 years or so for all the cells to turn over. But your ribs will turn over in about 2 years or something like that. So whatever signal, isotopic signal, is in your ribs represents the last 2 years of your life, but your thigh will be the last 15 years. But then other things like enamel, your enamel, so your tooth enamel is formed when you're a child, and then nothing happens. It's biologically inert, which means that it doesn't change. So whatever chemical signals are locked in your teeth during childhood stay there for the rest of your life. So my teeth, I grew up in Norway, so my teeth actually have the sort of Norwegian Viking signals. But if you grew up here in London, you would have London isotopic signals in your teeth.
So I've probably got like south of England, you know, bit of North America, maybe some Chile as well. So
perfect.
I've got everything. It would be very confusing to look at my teeth.
That is a good point, yeah.
Okay, so we're going to move on to your next song, which is Jim Croce with Time in a Bottle.
Yes.
Why do you choose this one?
So I have to consider it was actually chosen by my son, who really likes it. But I think when I was a child, I used to go to these museums. I used to go to the Viking ships. I used to go to the Kon-Tiki Museum that had all this research from Easter Island. And I was very obsessed with the past and travelling in time. I always wanted to time travel, actually. And this song, to me, represents that idea of what if you could just trap time and manipulate time, which obviously we can't do.
Brilliant. Here it is.
If I could save time in a bottle, the first thing that I'd like to do is to save every day till eternity passes away, just to spend them with you. If I could make days last forever, if words could make wishes come true, I'd say
news. This just in: Nobel Prize in Physics for laser firsts, and hint of a new particle over the Antarctic ice. So I've just got a couple of little news in articles for you today. This one about the new particle over the Arctic ice is quite amazing. So there are lots of detectors that are placed all over the world. You know, there's CERN, there's a big one filled with water in Japan, and there's one in Antarctica, which is like a big, it's called Ice Cube or something, where they just have ice.
Good name.
Yeah. And this one is called the ANITA. Okay. Which is a nice name. The Antarctic Impulsive Transient Antenna. And ANITA is in a weather balloon, essentially. And so they take this weather balloon, they float her up to 37 kilometres for about a month. And it searches for signals of high-energy particles from space, but ones that have come through the Earth.
Right.
So they use the Earth as like a big absorbing antenna, and some of the particles can interact with the matter and then change so that when they come out the other side of the planet, they're in a slightly different form. What they've found is they've found these kind of new signals which are consistent with low-energy neutrinos, and these low-energy neutrinos are then converted into something where they see a signal. Now, the thing is that they wouldn't expect to see these kind of signals from those particles. And so what they think is that maybe this is actually signals from a new particle, which would be a STOW, which is it's in a supersymmetry, which is this idea that these like particles have partners that are slightly heavier, and they interact with those. And this is kind of beyond the standard model physics. So this is completing the standard model with the Higgs boson, and now we're looking beyond it. And so these are doing kind of similar experiments to the way you would do at CERN, where they're smashing these particles together at massive speeds, but doing them over the ice in Antarctica, just by looking at signals that are already there from the absorption. which is quite amazing. So I thought that was quite cool. And the other thing I noticed was obviously the Nobel Prizes.
Yes.
And so the Nobel Prizes, so this one is for lasers, which is kind of my bag. I do a lot of lasers. Basically, the way I describe what I do is I shine lasers on things and see what happens. And so this is from the physicist Arthur Ashkin, Gerard Moreau, and Donna Strickland. They will split the 9 million Swedish krona prize. And so Ashkin developed these optical tweezers, which is essentially like a laser tractor beam. So you can trap an atom just by shining a laser on it. And he was actually using it for bacteria and other things. You can trap them and drag them around. So that's quite cool. Mm-hmm. And the other two, Moreau and Strickland, developed this technique called optical parametric amplification, which is essentially like chirped pulse amplification. I'm getting very confused between the different types of amplification.
It's easily done.
Yeah, and so their technique, it was a way of actually like spreading out a laser pulse and then recompressing it. And what you end up with is a very, very intense, very, very short laser pulse. And this has led to the development of things like eye surgery and machine like development. So you can actually now have lasers that cut steel and that sort of thing. And they really need these kind of short burst things. So that's our news for the day.
I think we should also mention, Strickland is the first female physics Nobel laureate for 55 years.
Exactly.
Which I think is
good, but also, come on.
Come on, guys.
we need to sort this out.
Yeah.
All these comments, which we do not agree with. But congratulations to all of those, Donna Strickland, Gerard Moreau, and Arthur Ashkin. So we're going to move on to your next song. This is The Water, also by Johnny Flynn. Why did you like this one?
Again, another song I really like, but I actually spend a lot of time thinking about water for a number of reasons that I think we're going to talk about in a moment.
Mm, yeah, definitely. So here we go. This is The Water with Johnny Flynn and also Laura Marlin. We've been learning a lot about your techniques and about the different things that you've been doing. And are these techniques kind of still relevant today? Because we've got food that comes from all over the world. I can buy, apples from South Africa. Is this still relevant?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And the assumption is that in the past, people were really eating much more local food. We obviously know that people imported things in the past. If you think about the Roman Empire, they had foods from all over the place. So in Roman Britain, you could get food from other parts of the Roman Empire entirely, but there was probably not that much of it.
Yeah.
But now we do eat, as you say, quite a lot of especially things like fruit. But really, I think a lot of the bulk of our diet is things like our bread, things that are actually made quite locally. And a lot of what we drink as well is very local. So milk, for example, is going to come from your surrounding.
Just because it doesn't keep very well, doesn't travel very well, milk.
Exactly. Yeah. And very much the water as well. So a lot of the isotopes, the oxygen isotopes, I look at a lot. Most of the oxygen we have in our bodies will come from our drinking water.
Oh, right. Okay, so it is still quite relevant. This is hence the water.
Yes, exactly. I spend a lot of time looking at this and looking at the variations in water, which is something that we're mapping quite a lot. And as part of my PhD research, I actually wanted to look at oxygen isotopes across Scandinavia, and we don't have a lot of reference measurements of that. So a lot of it is based on just modelling. So as a part of my research, I actually got help from a lot of volunteers collecting tap water samples from all over the country.
All right.
Looking at the variation in isotopes and then making that into a map.
I think that's something you can taste, right? The water never tastes as good to where you grew up. It's such a reassuring taste.
Exactly.
You travel all over the world and you go back to your tap and you're like, oh wow, it just tastes so good.
It's better than anywhere else.
And so I'm thinking, are there any kind of new investigations, things that you're getting excited about now?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this is used in forensic work as well, which I think is really exciting. So obviously, I work on the Vikings, which I think is very important, but there's some other issues. I know these methods are being used a lot more now in forensics. And one issue is things like unknown dead from either unsolved crimes or even from war, earlier wars as well.
Oh, wow.
So in cases where bodies have been repatriated from, say, the First or the Second World War, occasionally we can't, or quite often, we can't actually identify who those bodies belong to. If you don't have a reference to compare it to, then DNA is of no use at all.
Right, yeah.
So they're now beginning to use isotope analysis quite a lot more for that as well, which I think is a really great way to do it.
So it's really coming to be a modern technique that's being used to do things like this repatriation.
Yeah, and in addition to this, lots of other applications, like things like looking at food fraud, for example, because we can tell something about where food comes from or drink. You can investigate, say, if the champagne you're drinking actually does come from France or if it's a fake.
Yeah, and there's a lot of stuff at the moment with, you know, managing the food chain and having, you know, have to information of where stuff comes from, because as we were saying before, food now does move around all over the world.
Yeah.
And not knowing where it comes from means that you can be safety issues and that sort of thing. So obviously this is now something that can be brought into to make the food that we're eating even a lot safer.
Yeah, and also environmental reasons. So things like fish, for example, making sure that fish is sustainable, that people are following the rules about where they're allowed to fish. So I have colleagues who work on this, who work on making reference maps so that you can take fish from a supermarket and actually look at the isotope ratios in it and see if it was caught in the place that it was meant to be caught.
That they said it was going to be caught.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Exactly. Well, Barbara, so we're going to have to leave it there, I'm afraid. Kat, it's been so great to have you on. Is there anything that your people should look out for? How can they find out a little bit more about the work that you do?
They're very welcome to follow me on Twitter. I put updates on everything I do there. So my Twitter handle is @KatJarman. All my research that I've done into this has been published as open access articles that are freely available online. So search for my name and archaeology and they should all come up.
Well, brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting me.
That's quite all right. You've been listening to Science Mixtape with me, Kyle Major. We have all our previous shows up as podcasts. Just search for Science Mixtape. If you fancy, come follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We're @ScienceMixtape. And why not message us? Tell us what your favourite episode is. We're about to hit 100 episodes. And so we want to know, what was your favourite? What was the most interesting fact? Which bit made you cringe the most? I've got a few of those I can remember. Let us know. Finally, we're going to play on your last song, Kat. This is Birdie with Skinny Love. Any particular reason that you chose this?
Only that I really love the song.
Well, that's as good a reason as any. Here, thank you and goodbye.
Come on, skinny love, just last the year. Poor little soul, we were never here. My. Staring at the sink of blood and crushed veneer.